And now, attempt to concentrate completely on your duty of the moment, or on the traveler, on his well-being. Think of him as someone you care deeply for.
Greetings, everyone. Matt here, and welcome to Star Trek Essentials. Our voyage each week, review the very best of the first 50 years of the Star Trek franchise. Joining me, as always, is Pete. Hiya, Pete.
Hello, number one.
Oh, you're the Picard in this situation, eh?
I am.
Well, apropos indeed, today we're talking about the Star Trek The Next Generation episode entitled Where No One Has Gone Before. Pete, before we do that, tell us a little bit about Star Trek TNG.
Absolutely. Well, Star Trek The Next Generation was the second live-action Star Trek series to ever air, bowing in the fall of 1987 to much ballyhoo. Star Trek, the film series, was riding high and off the success of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. They were bringing the flagship back to TV. Channel 11 in my area, WPIX, was the one to carry it in terms of the modified syndication type situation. And I remember it coming on a Monday. We had recently head back to school, and it was not really on a lot of kids' radars. I remember that much. What I do remember, though, is this is a series that I was with for the most part. Watched a lot of it early on in its run, got away from it. I think a moment that brought a lot of viewership back and increased the ratings was the end of the third season, the beginning of the fourth season. And by the end of its seven-season run, it was hailed as a classic and really instrumental in relaunching Star Trek on the small screen. The episode we're going to talk about today, Where No One Has Gone Before, very politically correct again.
Oh, absolutely.
A product of the 1980s. But the type of idea here where the first two episodes aired as one movie. So a 2-hour first episode, Encounter at Farpoint. And then we get to a situation where this episode is the fifth standalone episode and really where they started to get into some hardcore exploration.
Indeed, and as a quick little refresher for everyone, as you said, it was the first episode of the season. It's numbered 106. Although if you go to Netflix and perhaps other sources now, it's called 105 because of the combining of the two as one episode. And as a quick little plot refresher. This, of course, is set on the Enterprise D. The Enterprise is visited by Mr. Kaczynski and the alien known as the Traveler. The Traveler sends the Enterprise to distant parts of the universe, and help is required from good old Wesley Crusher to bring the ship home.
I remember one of the most biting pieces of criticism at the time, referring to the Enterprise D as a flying dentist office. I remember that piece of criticism very vividly from when I was 11 years old getting into this.
I find no fault with the set design. We'll talk a little bit about some of the lighting and whatnot for this episode, this part of the first season. But to me, this is the iconic design. This has not aged. The Enterprise D, to my view, it has not aged. The whole ramp, two-tier thing in the bridge. Occasionally, you'll see somebody really hoofing it to get up that ramp to get to the back part of the bridge quickly in order to let the shot continue to flow or whatever. But other than that, and that's kind of more of an acting TV show thing.
Right.
To me, this is the, I mean, I know the classic Trek bridge is perhaps more iconic. To me, this is the one where it's like, man, that's what I want to see one day out there.
Well, this was your joint, Matt. You know, I came to Star Trek through the movies. You know, this was in your wheelhouse as far as your exposure.
Absolutely. Correct? 7.5 years old, watching that first episode, you know, the double length, the Counter Farpoint, before the next episode, Naked Now, before that had even aired. So it was in that first week. And somewhere, I doubt I have it at this point, but for years, I had this VHS tape I had lovingly made of the first six episodes minus Last Outpost.
Okay, so you had Code of Honor. You had the battle of the two women on the electrified jungle gym.
Well, not just that about Code of Honor. Code of Honor will never appear in Star Trek Essentials. It is a noteworthy episode to see. But for those of you who have not seen it, and I think some people in our audience might be saying, I've seen every episode of Star Trek. Why are you doing that? We have some other people who have, say, joined this podcast who are casual Star Trek fans or who are watching these episodes ahead of us. You know, they're watching for the first time. That particular episode, Pete, I think you could fairly say involves the Enterprise going to the planet of the African blacks, where these aliens who are just African American people with no, you know, space glitter or extra antenna. They're kind of there. The men are kind of bare chested, maybe with kind of a vest sort of tunic, but kind of they're bare chested African men, and, you know, very kind of like, you must respect me in my new lands, kind of that sort of, you know, African-esque accent. But
Matt,
however,
I will remind you, since we're talking about a show that, you know, came at the rise of the politically correct movement, it is African-American.
Pete, I'm talking specifically from the continent of Africa.
And I'm talking about the planet of Africa, America.
Well, to wrap up the reflection on that episode before we truly get into Where No One Has Gone Before, the key turning point is when the tribal leader of the planet has his eye turned by the blonde Caucasian Tasha Yar, which, yes, he's willing to put everything on the line and break up his society and his marriage because of the blonde white woman. And you're sitting here going, oh my goodness, this is the show that had like the first interracial kiss. This is the show that, you know, has explored issues of the planet, you know, the whales in Star Trek IV and rebirth and regeneration and getting old and kind of all these universal things. And now we're having the guy from the planet of the Africans likes himself white women enough to put everything on the line.
But Matt, three words: electrified jungle gym.
They do fight Tasha, and I believe her name is Yarina, which always struck me as weird. Like, it's Tasha Yar versus his wife Yarina. Like, okay, we didn't have to try too hard on that one. But yes, they do fight on an electrified jungle gym with poison spike gloves.
Yes,
it's hideous.
It's a metaphor.
For what, I don't know. But
it's a metaphor.
Let's Before we properly get into this episode, which, by the way, will be an analysis episode, some weeks, like next week, will be commentary tracks. People want to share the love for Star Trek Essentials. What are a couple ways to do that?
Absolutely. Well, please feel free to share your episode feedback at any time. Our Twitter is @podcaststartrek, all one word. The listener line, you can call in at area code 412-447-1701. And again, those last four digits should have some significance for listeners, particularly for the next generation. And then, Matt, how else can they get in touch with us?
Well, they also could send an email to StarTrekEssentials@gmail.com or leave a comment on the webpage, StarTrekEssentials.blogspot.com, or even give us a nice rating and comment on the iTunes machine.
There you go.
So with that, Pete, let's finally get into this episode, Where No One Has Gone Before. And Pete, I think a great place to start would be talking about the promise of the final frontier. We've had kind of the first five episodes or so to kind of get settled, and here we're finally going out there. So with that, Pete, What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, this episode is out there, and I have very, again, vivid memories of this episode early on, though its air date was October 26th. I saw it closer to Halloween. I remember getting back in from trick-or-treating and flipping this on and being like, you know, damn, son, this some out there Star Trek or whatever, you know, type of jive I was speaking at the time. You know, between the warp engine where they wind up, and then we get into all the hallucinations and everything else like that. You know, this was not, you know, the Star Trek movie idea, and this was certainly not a plot line that the original show ever carried off. Not that they wouldn't have been capable, but you know, and Matt, I know you're going to talk about this in a little greater detail, the special effects and getting digital effects thrown at us, particularly so early in the episode, the warp simulations and everything like that, and you know, seeing these computer graphics on our TV of all places in 1987, this caught attention.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely are episodes throughout all seven seasons, particularly in the first and second, where the age of the show, you know, 1987 shows. Pete and I are both working off of, by the way, you know, the non-remastered version. Pete, do you watch on Netflix?
I do, but I also have, as with all of the Star Trek shows, I have the DVDs. I alternate depending on what's easiest to get to at the moment.
Right, right.
This I did watch on Netflix.
So, I mean, either way, we're both working off of the, you know, the non-remastered. Right. That said, it's just, this episode in particular, it's just incredible effects. When they first arrive at Galaxy M33, it's a home run in terms of it looking kind of vaguely familiar, the way we kind of expect a science fiction galaxy to look. And then when they head to that end of the universe, it's just surreal. And I know it was done with, you know, Christmas lights and reflections off of the effects guy's basement wall and all that. And I mean, look, if we were to take just that footage, which I know was done at a very low definition rate, and just simply put that on Blu-ray, I'm sure it wouldn't look great, don't get me wrong, but the essence of it is just amazing. It just, you know, for the degree that it's interspersed with the rest of the episode, you know, with its lower resolution and all that, it,
some goofy music,
yeah,
those early Lycra looking awkward uniforms, complete with some guys still walking around with skirts,
excuse me, those were skorts. Yeah, thanks Gene for imagining the day one day when men are comfortable in skirts for part of one season. But yeah, the effects, you know, here we have again the kind of the category that we're in right now, the promise of the final frontier. These effects are fantastic. And Pete, I just wanted to talk to you, and speaking of going out there, it's not just kind of where the Enterprise goes, it's these hallucinations. It's like you get some characterization there with Worf and his quote unquote kitty cat, his Targ.
Yes.
There's you know, the nameless characters. There's the woman doing ballet in an almost good, but imperfect shot, you know, where I think it's this jump cut as the light shines into the camera and she's spinning and she's now no longer in the ballet outfit.
Right.
Points for, you know, you get points for conception, even though they didn't quite pull it off. The guy in the string quartet, that just still sticks with me this day, that when he kind of wakes up out of his little daydream, this kind of the string goes, nah, you know, almost Giacchino-esque, mm-hmm, if you will. Most of all, though, you talk about remembering this episode. I distinctly remember watching this episode with my parents. Hey, it's those fun Star Trek people that go on their adventures. All of a sudden, Tasha Yar is like, oh, I just flash back to a rape gang chasing me. And me at 7 years old going, I know that's a bad thing. I don't think I should ask, but those boys with the flashlights didn't look like they were nice, and I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, that was definitely jarring. You knew from the moment that she referred to Worf's Targ as a kitty cat that, they were foreshadowing she would see her own. And then, you know, apparently the last time she saw the kitty, there was a seriously traumatic incident. But Picard in the elevator nearly falling out, Picard and his mama. The flamer who's in the hallway, unable to get to engineering or wherever he's headed. And Picard just walks him through, dominating his thoughts. You know, you got to control those thoughts, Matt. Okay. It's all about the energy of thought. You know, the traveler is the lens. And I think somebody at some point, I have in my notes here, nonsense. Somebody refers to it as nonsense. And points for the attempt as a coherent whole. I think this episode definitely did not hold up as well as I remembered it.
See, it's funny that you should say that. And maybe this is just, you know, baked into my experience of, you know, when I saw it at a slightly younger age, maybe a bit more wide-eyed. Also, the number of times I've seen this episode, and I have not seen it in, maybe I've seen it once previous to watching it for the podcast, once in the period of time that Star Trek, all the Star Treks ended up on Netflix. But before that, it had been years and years and years and years. But I have this episode almost shot for shot, just baked into my brain. There's in a rewatch, there's nothing in this episode that can surprise me, nothing that doesn't feel familiar. I just feel like, are there better episodes of The Next Generation? Yes. Are there better episodes in the first season? Maybe. You know, we might get to them. Neutral Zone jumps out in my mind as kind of having a strong Romulan thing, but then the fact that there's the strange, you know, humans from the 21st century kind of takes away a bit. But Pete, to me, this is an essential, you know, not to jump to the end, why is it essential? But like, this is on the list because it's just swinging for the fences.
Oh, they definitely took the risks. But, you know, the moment your eyes are battered by Wesley Crusher's tan sweater, you're like, man, what have I gotten myself into right here? And again, the aim of this incarnation of Star Trek, like you said, was certainly high, but they just didn't hit it early on. But I'm a firm believer they don't get to where they are later if they didn't, you know, kind of, work these episodes, these types of ideas and, you know, tropes and things like that out of the system.
Well, I'm again going to disagree slightly. And again, you know, 7-year-old me watching this episode, I was just like, yeah, some smart, you know, some smart kid, he could absolutely be like running the show to this degree and be trying to deliver important information about the phasing alien to the first, to second in command, who wouldn't listen to him because grownups are dumb, man. To me, I love the Wesley stuff. 7-year-old me loved the Wesley stuff. Adult
well,
me
that's
looks
because Wesley is actually 7 years old. But the idea here, you know, I'll further my thesis back that they left the Milky Way and they've traveled 2 galaxies over. They're 300 years away from home. So basically in 1987, they nailed the 8-year plot structure of Star Trek Voyager. Okay.
Well,
and then the other fact that in reality, it would be absolutely terrifying upon those 2 jumps to realize, where are we? Oh my God, there's nothing out here that we could subsist off of. We're never going to get back. We are screwed. To me, would have been a more compelling place to take this episode instead of the hallucination, psychological terror that is less than effective.
Well, I think there's a couple things going on in this episode. I think one is they're trying to figure out
there's
exactly
some things going on. We're going to get to that in a moment.
I think so much of the first season of Star Trek The Next Generation really is Star Trek, you know, that you knew about, the Kirk stuff, but The Next Generation, just kind of updated. Kind of, you know, TNG didn't become the show that we look back on mostly into season three. I mean, season two, there's some strong stuff, but there's a writer's strike going on then. This is an episode where it's not about, you know, like, I think it's a season five episode where, like, Commander Riker meets a genderless person and makes her feel girl feelings. And it's an episode actually about homosexuality. Like, this is an episode that's about the big questions of the day. This isn't even Save the Whales. This is just like, we're just going out there. We're finding crazy stuff. And darn it, we're just going to go crazy because we can, because, you know, whatever. Also, just to return to Wesley for a second, adult me looks back and says, this, I don't know what the grand Wesley plan was, but the effect of this episode is to say, the Wesley that we saw in The Naked Now, where he's just going to solve everything with his repulsor beam and his pulling his chips, and he's just going to do it all because he's actually smarter than everyone. They're dialing it back a bit by saying, all right, well, if he's that good, let's make him some sort of like quasi-officer. And yeah, it's going to be the rainbow top that, you know, with the three colors. It still doesn't look that great, but let's dial back the kid, you know, Kids Are Us sweaters and start to kind of make him a junior officer. And then on top of that, we're saying, oh, and he is such a boy genius. And guess what? You know, the Traveler sees it. You know, well, there really is something there.
And for me, you know, a perfect segue into where we're going next. For me, this really ups the Wesley destiny angle. Not a spoiler, but for anybody who's not seen all of the show, you know, he eventually is
dead all along.
Phased out. No, he was not dead along.
Oh.
Okay. He's just a boy. But, you know, here, all right, so we get to the acting Ensign Crusher. This begins that, you know, painful subplot.
painful, erroneous. It makes him part of the grown-up story.
Well, you know, you talk about him, you know, solving the episode before, you know, and this is really the segue into his larger story, the metaphysical story, that he's special beyond this crew, that he's more important than them even, because of his abilities. So let's talk about him and the Traveler in a story that would never be allowed to run on TV in the year 2013.
Why do you say that, Pete?
The kid touching vibe on a scale of 1 to 10 is at 11 the way it is played in this episode. And that is no offense to either of the actors. The Traveler actor, Eric Menyuk, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Matt, do you know anything about him?
Didn't he go on to be a lawyer?
That I don't know, but I can tell you he was the runner-up for the Data role.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so this episode and this role, which he recurs on two other occasions throughout the 7-season run, this was the consolation prize. And it's a fairly plum role for somebody who didn't get, you know, what would become an iconic role on this show. Really the breakout role, if you would, in Data. But the way that he plays it and the way that they interact, particularly coupled with the dislikable character he's kind of traveling with, is very, very hard to watch right now. And I cannot imagine any executives at any studio right now signing off on the way that they interact and the way that it comes across.
It speaks to kind of the myopic view that I have of this episode. Yes, of course I knew he was the runner up to Data. Side note, he indeed is an attorney. Did a quick Google search. You can go to menyucklaw.com. Nice. Looks like it perhaps has not been updated in a while.
Does the interior of his law firm look like the bridge of the Enterprise D or Main Engineering?
Well, the background on his website is actually kind of a fine oak, as you might find on the horseshoe. So I guess, you know, had a different casting decision been made, would there be like spinerlaw.com and, you know, Brent Spiner would kind of
freshhell.com.
Sticking with the Traveler there, I thought that the makeup was was quite good. I'm not going to say fantastic. I wanted to, but the makeup is quite good.
Oh, definitely. The hands, the forehead.
Yeah, I mean, it's not often that you see hand prosthetics. Again, you know, part of what this podcast is about, not this episode, but part of what Star Trek Essentials is about is that for each of these Star Trek series, you and I bring a slightly different perspective. Certainly when we get into some of the Voyager and particularly Star Trek Enterprise stuff, you know, you're the expert. You've seen all of them. I have not seen all of either Voyager or Enterprise. Well, obviously I'll see the episodes we discuss. Similarly here, yeah, we both watched Next Generation back in the day, but like there's still seven-year-old me who can't quite see what you're talking about, you know, concerning the Traveler-Wesley connection.
11-year-old me is not seeing it either. But,
right.
You know, particularly watching this now, you know, and evaluating it from the standpoint of, you know, where TV is now and where TV is then, you know, between the vibe with the two characters, you know, and the just the overly friendly neighbor type of aspect seemed very, very tough, you know, and then Kaczynski with boy, don't play with that, you know, and the idea of the boy and that they develop over the course of this episode and later on, they develop this special attachment. It's played much better in the later episodes because I don't know, maybe there was this whole thing with the Catholic Church, you know, that really came to the forefront in the early 90s. And I think some studio execs said, okay, well, this is where we were at when he was on before. And now can we just say he wants to go with him on a trip?
I can't disagree completely. I mean, the Wesley stuff is a bit thick at times. You know, the whole "Mom, he's my friend." Like, you're right. He does come off as seven versus. I mean, I don't know Will Wheaton's age now or back then. Will Wheaton. I mean, what would you peg Wesley in season one to be, about like 13, 14?
Yeah.
So he definitely is playing. And again, Wesley, I don't know, Will Wheaton might have been younger, might have been older, but I feel like the character was probably about 13 or 14.
And listen, he was one of the established actors on these shores. He was a huge coup for them to score coming off of Stand By Me. And, you know, he was somebody, you know, he wasn't kicked off The Next Generation. He left The Next Generation to go do more work in films, and unfortunately it backfired on him. But, you know, and again, this is no knock on him. I mean, he is much maligned in the fandom, you know, but it's as it's written and played, not as it's played, if that makes sense.
That
it comes across, you know, in a difficult way.
I mean, you could probably, I'm just going through the cast in my head, you could probably make the argument that he had a brighter star than the guy who had done a little bit of British TV and a couple of movies in this country versus, you know, Frakes coming off of, I want to say, a Civil War miniseries or something, versus Gates McFadden, who, you know, had choreographed some stuff, you know, and worked with the Muppets.
Listen, you know, he's the second most established actor on the show at the start of the series, and the first being your boy.
Well, I was even going to say, as much as I love LeVar Burton, my, you know, my hero in so many ways, this was probably 10 years after Roots. So, I mean, LeVar Burton.
Yeah, but he was reading Rainbow and it up. He had been in enough, you know. Did his career need a jump start and a more stable platform? Of course. But, you know, compared to a kid actor, I got to go with LeVar Burton over, a prominent kid actor any day.
Fair enough. Well, with that, should we move on to talking about our favorite warp engine charlatan, Mr. Kaczynski?
The guy is just unlikable and, you know, plays it as it's written and it works here. You know, tonally, I have a little bit of an issue between, you know, how bitter and gruff early on, particularly in this episode, Picard is, you know, run flat against the ego of a Kaczynski. Can I ask a question, Matt?
Absolutely, Pete.
Okay, so you're rendezvousing with another Federation ship that apparently a 75-year-old version of which is flying around in the Fearless, which is the model apparently of the Excelsior and looks just like the late Kirk days. Okay.
Side note, it actually is the same effect shot from Encounter Farpoint when that Excelsior class ship drops off McCoy.
Yes.
It's just without the planet in the background.
Right. And okay. So, you know, early days of these types of effects, and I give them a pass for reusing it. Okay. Maybe get a new ship. But anyway, okay.
Well, not to interrupt, side note, the USS New Jersey that was built and fought in World War II also saw action 50 years later in the first Gulf War, obviously in a much smaller capacity. But like the United States of America has 50-year-old ships still in action.
Yeah, but Matt, your iPhone 4S is almost three generations behind. So now what?
Well,
you're telling me starships, 75 years, we're not going to have, more updated models. All right. Maybe that's why they're working on the engine regardless.
Yeah, there you go. Anyhow, I'm sorry.
Then it doesn't make sense that he's revising the engine of, the Federation flagship. But we digress. OK, so he comes on and, can I ask why you're receiving an officer, albeit an engineer, okay, a tech specialist, and a companion from another Federation ship, and you're greeting them with the ship psychologist to see what they're about. You know, that to me is having, is like having your shrink evaluate the plumber.
Well, but I mean, isn't part of it that they don't know, like, what his deal is?
I know, but it tips its hand so early that something is up. And again, on rewatch, obviously.
Well, wait. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to totally interrupt you. Finish your thought, and then I will knock it down.
Sure. On rewatch, obviously, it's far more apparent. But it speaks to, again, where they bungled these characters early with, Deanna. I can't feel the one but the other, blah 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 blah. It really was a lot of that early on, and they had split the two characters. They had split the one character. The Macha Hernandez character was going to be the female character who was just going to be the security officer, and they split that character in the series Bible into two and created Tasha Yar and created Deanna Troi. And I think we see the worst of both characters in this episode in getting to the Kaczynski character.
Here's my explanation for it. We're still at there's gruff Picard that we'll get into in greater detail in a little bit. But we're at a point story-wise where I think Picard, it's certainly we're still in the phase from Encounter Farpoint where it's like, hey, number one, I didn't exactly pick you. Like, you weren't handpicked. We were kind of posted together, and I'm still kind of getting to know what your deal is, how well I can trust you, what your strengths are, your weaknesses. So, right, here's my take on the first act. Riker is the one harping on, hey, this guy can't be all he seems to be. This guy can't be all he seems to be. So Picard basically says, in so many words, I'm tired of hearing about this, and or, fine, you care about it so much, you go investigate. Like, basically, not that Picard is as gruff as get out of my hair, but it's like, fine, you're my guy who's supposed to keep me in check. You're saying there's a problem. I don't see a problem. You keep telling me there's a problem. Go investigate the problem and report back. If you report back and say, hey, no problem, boss. All right. Well, guess what? You know why I'm captain. You come back and say, hey, we found a, box of, faulty hammers with him. He's a fraud. Okay, great. Now I know I can trust you a bit more. So,
Emmett, number one, get out of that chair of yours and do something.
Riker gets the okay, and as Riker's going out, he's like, pardon me, sir, do you think I could bring my ex-girlfriend, I mean, the counselor, who has special powers, including I like to be naked with her powers, can we hang, can her and I hang out on this little mission? And he's, Picard's like, sure, the one that can read minds or whatever, go ahead. So that's kind of my take, where it's like, hey, you have, Picard's point of view is, hey, you have a problem with this guy, you're not letting it go, you go investigate, you want to get help with that, fine, go pick whoever you need on your little team, she's sitting here on the bridge, you're going to go meet him in the transporter room, great, go for it.
Well, you know, again, here's another question, okay? So he's done this on other ships in the fleet with, you know, stunning, we're talking about Kaczynski here, with stunning results, okay? Were the other starship crews so completely oblivious to the Traveler winking out, and that's a reference to the original series, okay, winking out, phasing out, as Wesley points out, that they didn't see this going on? They really needed an empath to know, oh, we can't read him, something's up here.
I mean, I'll give it a little wiggle room there for story. Maybe their main engineerings are not as spaciously accommodating, so you can't see the Traveler from kind of your main console. You know, maybe the Traveler is kind of, you know, up in the duct or whatever, pushing his buttons whilst they're in the cramped, you know, the cramped control room on level two. I don't know, that kind of thing.
I don't know, Matt. It sounds mighty convenient. Okay. And then the fact that, okay, the first time he gets it to jump, and obviously we're dealing with a better engine on top of the fact that Wesley's there, bringing whatever he can out of the Traveler, okay, through their relationship. But, you know, the second time they go to warp, they wind up even further away. Hello, can you even turn the thing around? I thought for certain that I was misremembering this episode, and that, you know, once they wind up really far away, that the second time when they wind up really, really far away was in the other direction. Like almost, oh man, we just overshot Earth and everything else we ever know right now. And now we're 300 years from home. But it's still in the same direction.
Oh, I see what you're saying. That for the try part two, they should have been facing.
Yeah.
Are you sure about that?
I'm 100% sure.
Okay.
I'm 100% sure. And that would have been a thing, you know, for somebody to completely, you know, and yes, they find out on the second attempt, all right, this guy is not controlling this. The other guy is. But wouldn't anybody think to turn the ship around? I mean, is this some kind of, Roadrunner Wile E. Coyote maneuver? We're basically going to go so fast, we're going to return on the other side. Is that what they were hoping for?
You raise a fair point. You certainly raise a fair point.
Okay. You know, that they don't recur, reverse course, I think is, you know, a little bit of an issue. And then, you know, when, all right, so that second place they wind up and the physics of space no longer exist, and, you know, our attempt for what that point of deep space where, you know, thought and energy are converging is that, you know, there's a funny background and floaty, flashy things. I just think is,
well, wait,
a little bit more like Poltergeist than it is like, you know, science fiction.
I disagree there as well. I think that when they were at the edge of the universe or the end of the universe, whatever they call it, that was just meant to be so kind of still within the realm of you know, the physical universe, but just, you know, the effects were expressing something that was so completely foreign to our eyes. I think that when the Traveler has his bit about, you know, thought and reality and space and time, they're all connected, I think he was commenting kind of from a universal point of view. Like, they weren't at the place where thought was whatever. It was always there, and that he had kind of jump-started it for Ballerina Girl and String Quartet Guy, you know, and I Miss My Klingon Kitty Cat.
Oh, I disagree. I think they're in a place where it converges. They're not ready for it. So much of the run of this show, so many episodes are about humanity not yet ready. That's Q. Every episode, virtually every episode he's in, is humanity not quite ready for this larger universe, literally and figuratively, and seeing where they stack up. You know, introducing the Borg for the first time and then being able to pull them out of that before they're ready. You know, I think this is an absolute meta commentary, and it's not done from a standpoint of, you know, his narration is needed to put in perspective what we're seeing. But I think they're absolutely in a place where those things come together.
Fair enough, then.
Let's go science for a moment. You know, we know that the Big Bang exploded outward, okay? And, you know, if we're going to follow that through, then there's got to be a point where whatever the Big Bang banged bigly from, you know, is just on its outer portion where it's not as defined as it is in the center. And, you know, that would make perfect sense where, you know, laws of physics would, you know, lose their hold. And that's why it works for me, but it only works for me through what the Traveler gets at.
By the way, on the original draft for this plot, speaking of the Big Bang, was basically that, I don't have it in front of me, that their attempt to get home, like, they were out there for 6 days, and then they, in their attempt to get home, they created a new universe and therefore got to rest on the seventh, making the USS Enterprise, you know, God or something. Wow. So I'm kind of glad they didn't quite do that.
Yeah. Ooh, that could have been dicey.
And as another side note, I know the original title was Where No One Has Gone. No, Where None
No
Have
Man.
Gone Before.
Oh, which, it wasn't No Man.
No. It was Where None Have Gone Before. So when you have this moment in the episode where they go, where are we? And Data goes, where none have gone before. That would have been a lot cooler if he said the name of the episode.
He just said the episode title.
He almost said the episode title.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think the final point we're going to look at for today is, you know, who knew long journeys could kill the giant bug up Captain Picard's posterior? You know, this guy is, you know, terminally, you know, buggered in the first couple episodes. And this finally begins to break the ice. He allows the boy to stay on the bridge after this, you know, and really gets in touch with his feelings. You know, hey, everybody, let's control those thoughts. Let's think about the Traveler's well-being. You know, yeah.
Captain Picard, yes. This episode had me wondering, though, you know, it's famous how Patrick Stewart thought it was just going to be 13 episodes, make some money, go back to London, lived in a hotel for the first season because he was just perpetually perplexed why they weren't getting canceled. I wondered if, you know, and look, we can all agree Patrick Stewart is a fine actor, perhaps the best or the most skilled actor that Star Trek has had. But I kind of felt like you could see Patrick Stewart wondering, is this the episode where we all get canceled? When he addresses the crew, the whole work together thing,
Go
back and watch it. I have the clip, you know, to at the top of the episode. I genuinely think there's this moment where he kind of pauses. It's a dramatic pause, but he kind of, like, his eyes move for a second. And I really think that he's just like, holy crap, this is so not Shakespeare. This is so not challenging. This is like, this is tripe, and I hope nobody at home sees this. I really genuinely
believe all of your thoughts on the Traveler.
On each other or the Traveler, the one known as the Traveler. We can all work together.
Think good thoughts and we will get back from Neverland.
The flip side is, I think that speech does is part of what makes this episode essential. But first, I just want to take a quick look at this episode in terms of what I like to call oh, 1980s. We have some odd close-ups, like when Riker and Troy are outside the transporter room. One of them, I think it's Riker, is especially close to the camera. Like, when he walks out of the shot, you can almost see, like, it's almost like he's too close, like he's now overly lit because he's too close to the light. There's some kind of overset blocking. You know, blocking is where you tell the actors to go stand. When Picard is asking the crew for ideas, before he's asked for ideas, Geordi stands up and then Data stands up kind of behind him so that they can be in the shot. And he's like, I'll take some ideas. And, you know, first we go to Worf, and then literally it's just like, well, we could do this, we could do that. It's like, I'm sitting here going, whoa, can you let the boss be like, all right, good idea, tell me more? Or like, no, I don't want to go in that direction. So if your idea is like his idea, I don't want to hear it. Like, it's just kind of this moment, like, I want to hear from everybody. It's like, gee whiz, Dad, we could go fishing or we could go for a drive. It's just like, oh, you know, there's that. And then quickly, Pete, I want to talk about the underlit sets. This was part of the season one lighting plan. I know at a certain point, I can't remember whether it's toward the end of season one or beginning of season two, they officially abandoned that lighting scheme for kind of the brighter aspect. But particularly when we're in sick bay and the traveler is in the central sick bay bed, you cannot see the background. And I'm sitting here going,
yeah, it did strike me as very dark in there.
Yeah. You know, and granted, this is from our perspective now, where for the last 15 years, Hollywood has either been preparing for or living under the reality of HD, giant TVs, stuff where, you know, you need to build that set out to excellent detail because people will see it, because it's going to be appreciated. This is stuff that, you know, for 4 or 5 years before HD was kind of mainstream, they were building new long-term sets with that in mind. Hey, we need to go out and get the right patina for the fireplace whoosie-whatses in the background, because if this show doesn't use it, some show is going to use this and it needs to look good. Here, it's like the complete opposite. They have a wonderful sick bay set, which we cannot see because literally the lights are off. It's like some surreal set. It's like the Six Characters in Search of an Exit Twilight Zone episode where, like, you can't see beyond the shadows.
Well, what becomes amazing throughout the course of this show's run is how awesome it looks in the later seasons. And here, it really doesn't look that good at all.
Yeah, it's finding its footing.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. It's the total, you know, nexus of the uniforms, of the lighting, of the set, of all of that, and it just and the performances, I think, too, and the scripts. I mean, it really is everything. And by the, you know, late middle to end of its run, you know, even to today, it's not dated itself terribly. I mean, you can still tell it's a product of the 1990s, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't look anywhere near as dated as this does.
I would agree. And I mean, you speak a bit about the evolution of the show. I mean, can you imagine that, the title isn't in my head at the moment, but can you imagine that fantastic two-parter from the middle portion of the series where, you know, Picard is captured and tortured? If they did that in season one, it would be, there are no lights.
Yeah. Oh, dude, it would.
Because you're underlit. See? Yeah, boom!
It would be, you know, on top of your pun there, it would be too rough, again, tonally, to try to get at, you know, and that's where, again, you know, I'll correct myself on what I was saying, you know, the idea that the terror that would strike you, oh my God, we are so far from home, we are never getting home, we're so far from home, we created the spinoff after the next one, that's how far from home we are, okay, we've gone two shows over, is how far they went, not even realizing it, or maybe they did and just said, you know what, that's our show in 1995. But, you know, I just think that would have been compelling, like trying to come to grips with the reality. You know, we have the naked nows and, you know, those kind of stories, you know, there's the one, I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, you know, there's an entire subgenre of episodes where Picard and someone else from the ship are coming back from a conference and they return to an Enterprise that is, you know, suffered whatnot. You know, there's the one where there's, you know, a Romulan black hole problem in the midst of a firefight and everybody's frozen. There's another one. The one I'm referring to explicitly here is where everyone de-evolves.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
directed by Gates McFadden.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, I think it was too early to go so dark and definitely too early to go as dark as they went later on, lighting, story, etc. You know, but Matt, let's talk about the Roddenberry effect.
Yes, I think it's the Roddenberry effect that makes this episode essential. It's the idea that it's not just that everybody wins by working together, which is the message of the show. You know, we're steeped in that. But then on top of it, we have the quiet, humble traveler who rises above the blustery Kaczynski. You know, it's kind of the Roddenberry idea of, you know, your skills will really rise above. And that said, you know, the traveler, he doesn't mind letting the other guy take the credit, because it's just like he's just trying to explore. And if the other guy wants to like get famous, like that's cool too. He's exploring. Kaczynski's exploring his own life, his own world. So.
See, what wound up on the cutting room floor or on the writer's room floor is the entire subplot that this was really about a space visa and the traveler's inability to acquire one, hence his marriage of convenience to Kaczynski.
Wow, Pete, a marriage of convenience, huh?
Yeah. And, you know, just moving forward, I hate to be rhetorical question guy, but I just got to ask one more. Was this whole sleigh ride, Matt, real, or was this all in their imagination?
Wow, that's a good question. I of course, need to return back to the science, where both Geordi and Data do recalculate their position, and, you know, in a real, you know, in reality. So I would guess reality. I like to think that the traveler's point about, you know, powered by imagination, which reminds me of that, you know, ride at Epcot.
Imagination.
But I don't think that figment. Makes this voyage a figment. See? From the ride. I don't think that makes the voyage. I think it's just saying, like, hey, we have this untapped potential in our minds to physically explore the world around us.
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly look at it that way. I think it's far too early for the psychological, you know, mind screw of, oh man, we just imagined it. We never move the whole time, but that they get back to the exact place, I think makes it a little bit of a stretch.
Do they not travel through time? Like, no, I don't mean like Back to the Future time travel. Like, these events did play out over time. They just returned to the space that they left. Is that my correct recollection?
Yeah, it feels like, I don't know. There's a cyclical nature to it that smacks a little bit of a dream.
I think that where you're getting that from is probably centered around the line where it's like, you know, they repeat it a couple times, like, we've never gone past warp 1.5.
Yes, yes.
I just kind of took that from the point of view of, hey, you have these awesome space rockets of the future that we in 1987 or 2013 can hardly dream of. I think they were saying, hey, you think these space rockets are impressive? How about the potential that you don't know you have?
Ding. Yeah.
With that, Pete, anything else you want to say about where no one has gone before?
No, I think we've covered it all, man. Thank God we've gone where no one has gone before, and you know, we don't have to go back anytime soon.
Indeed, this we almost went and didn't come back because we had a little technical snafu. Hopefully, we'll have some good outtakes after the end of the podcast, because we almost went there, didn't come back.
Well, listen, Kaczynski, you know, with you at the controls, no one would ever be the wiser.
Quiet, boy. Get away from there, boy. Get away from my manservant. Well, Pete, let's quickly, though, look ahead to next week. Next week will be an Enterprise episode from the first season, the 16th episode, Shuttle Pod 1. That'll be a commentary track. So if you haven't seen it, you could kind of watch along with us. And I'm looking forward to kind of delving into some newer Star Trek territory for me. I've seen a little bit of Enterprise, but certainly not as much as you. So whether you are the Picard for the Next Generation episodes, you definitely will be the Captain guy from Enterprise whose name is referenced in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, and he has a dog.
Archer?
Archer. You can be the Archer to my not Jolene Blaylock's Vulcan lady. Yeah. I'll be Trip.
Well, we're going to take you on a trip in this next episode. How about that?
Ooh, tantalizing. With that, I will say adios to everybody. And Pete, you can finish with one of your trademark zinger lines.
Now get that damn boy off my bridge, number one.
It's been a while since we've had the bubble.
What is the bubble?
The spinny ball thing.
The spinny beach ball of death? That thing sucks.
Yeah.
Momo.
Let's have tea because we're French.
Now, I thought for certain that was a grandmother. That's the mom. Maman means mom. Mummy.
Okay.
At least on translation from Wiktionary.
As long as it doesn't eat everything.
Yeah,
it,
right.
It could easily still be recording right now.
Crap and gold right now, man.
I know, really. I think it's been recording the entire time and we're good to go. Let me just... I'll stop recording for a second.
And
save.
And because I want to begin that last thought.
This is good outtakes. Maman.
Maman. Is my Picard that bad?
Yeah, your Picard's pretty good.
Thank you, number one.
I'd say as a comedic Picard, it's pretty good.
Make it so. We will see that history remembers the name Enterprise.
It's not like I have a trillion things open either. I don't want to push too many buttons, lest it just be like, oh, I'll just delete everything.
Yeah, don't do that.